can see that plate as clearly as I can see you now, Eddie. My mother gave it to Aunt Blue, and she cried and cried over it. I think she'd seen a plate like that once when she and my mother were children, only, of course, their parents could never have afforded such a thing. There was none of them who got anything for special as kids. After the reception, Aunt Blue and her husband left for the Great Smokies on their honeymoon. They went on the train. She looked at Eddie. "In the Jim Crow car," he said. "That's right, in the Crow car. In those days, that's what Negroes rode in and where they ate. That's what we were trying to change in Oxford Town." She looked at him, almost surely expecting him to insist she was here, but he was caught in the webwork of his own memory again. Wet diapers and those words, Oxford Town. Only suddenly other words came, just a single line, but he could remember Henry singing it over and over, until his mother asked if he couldn't please stop so she could hear Walter Cronkite. "Somebody better investigate soon." Those were the words, sung over and over by Henry in a nasal monotone. He tried for more, but couldn't get it, and was that any real surprise? He could have been no more than 3 at the time. "Somebody better investigate soon." The words gave him a chill. "Eddie, are you all right?"
"Yes, why?"
"You shivered." He smiled.
"Donald Duck must have walked over my grave."
She laughed. "Anyway, at least I didn't spoil the wedding. It happened when we were walking back to the railway station. We stayed the night with a friend of Aunt Blue's, and in the morning my father called a taxi. The taxi came almost right away, but when the driver saw we were colored, he drove off like his head was on fire and his ass was catching. Aunt Blue's friend had already gone ahead to the depot with our luggage. There was a lot of it, because we were going to spend a week in New York. I remember my father saying he couldn't wait to see my face light up when the clock in Central Park struck the hour and all the animals danced. My father said we might as well walk to the station. My mother agreed just as fast as lickety-split, saying that was a fine idea. It wasn't but a mile, and it would be nice to stretch our legs after 3 days on one train just behind us and half a day on another one just ahead of us. My father said yes, and it was gorgeous weather besides. But I think I knew, even at 5, that he was mad and she was embarrassed and both of them were afraid to call another taxicab because the same thing might happen again. So we went walking on down the street. I was on the inside because my mother was afraid of me getting too close to the traffic. I remember wondering if my daddy meant my face would actually start to glow or something when I saw that clock in Central Park, and if that might not hurt. And that was when the brick came down on my head. Everything went dark for a while. Then the dreams started. Vivid dreams. She smiled.
"Like this dream, Eddie."
"Did the brick fall, or did someone bomb you?"
"They never found anyone. The police, my mother told me this long after, when I was 16 or so, found the place where they thought the brick had been, but there were other bricks missing, and more were loose. It was just outside the window of a fourth-floor room in an apartment building that had been condemned. But, of course, there were lots of people staying there just the same, especially at night."
"Sure," Eddie said.
"No one saw anyone leaving the building, so it went down as an accident. My mother said she thought it had been, but I think she was lying. She didn't even bother trying to tell me what my father thought. They were both still smarting over how the cab driver had taken one look at us and driven off. It was that, more than anything else, that made them believe someone had been up there, just looking out, and saw us coming and decided to drop a brick on the niggers." "Will your lobster creatures come out soon?"
"No," Eddie said. "Not until dusk."
"So one of your ideas is that all of this is a coma dream like the ones you had when you got bopped by the brick. Only this time you'd think it was a billy club or something."
"Yes."
"What's the other one?"
Odetta's face and voice were calm enough, but her head was filled with an ugly skein of images which all added up to Oxford Town, Oxford Town. How did the song go? "Two men killed by the light of the moon. Somebody better investigate soon." Not quite right, but it was close. Close. "I may have gone insane," she said.
Seven.
The first words which came into Eddie's mind were, "If you think you've gone insane, Odetta, you're nuts." Brief consideration, however, made this seem an unprofitable line of argument to take. Instead, he remained silent for a time, sitting by her wheelchair, his knees drawn up, his hands holding his wrists.
"Were you really a heroin addict?"
"Am," he said. "It's like being an alcoholic or basing. It's not a thing you ever get over. I used to hear that and go, yeah, yeah, right, right, in my head, you know, but now I understand. I still want it, and I guess part of me will always want it, but the physical part has passed."
"What's basing?" she asked.
"Something that hasn't been invented yet, nor when. It's something you do with cocaine, only it's like turning TNT into an A-bomb."
"You did it?"
"Christ, no. Heroin was my thing, I told you."
"You don't seem like an addict," she said.
Eddie actually was fairly spiffy, if that was one ignored the gamey smell arising from his body and clothes. He could rinse himself, and did, could rinse his clothes, and did, but lacking soap, he could not really wash either. His hair had been short when Roland stepped into his life, the better to sail through customs, my dear, and what a great big joke that had turned out to be, and was still a respectable length. He shaved every morning, using the keen edge of Roland's knife, gingerly at first, but with increasing confidence. He'd been too young for shaving to be a part of his life when Henry left for Nam, and it hadn't been any big deal to Henry back then either. He never grew a beard, but sometimes went 3 or 4 days before Mom nagged him into mowing the stubble. When he came back, however, Henry was a maniac on the subject, as he was on a few others. Foot powder after showering, teeth to be brushed 3 or 4 times a day, and followed by a chaser of mouthwash, clothes always hung up. And he turned Eddie into a fanatic as well. The stubble was mowed every morning and every evening. Now this habit was deep in his grain, like the others Henry had taught him, including, of course, the one you took care of with a needle.
"Too clean cut?" he asked her, grinning.
"Too white," she said shortly, and then was quiet for a moment, looking sternly out at the sea. Eddie was quiet, too. If there was a comeback to something like that, he didn't know what it was.
"I'm sorry," she said. "That was very unkind, very unfair, and very unlike me."
"It's all right."
"It's not. It's like a white person saying something like, 'Geez, I never would have guessed you were a nigger,' to someone with a very light skin."
"You like to think of yourself as more fair-minded," Eddie said.
"What we like to think of ourselves and what we really are rarely have much in common, I should think. But yes, I like to think of myself as more fair-minded. So please accept my apology, Eddie."
"On one condition."
"What's that?"
She was smiling a little again. That was good. He liked it when he was able to make her smile.
"Give this a fair chance. That's the condition."
"Give what a fair chance?" She sounded slightly amused. Eddie might have bristled at that tone in someone else's voice, might have felt he was getting boned. But with her it was different. With her it was all right. He supposed with her just about anything would have been.
"That there's a third alternative. That this really is happening. I mean..."
Eddie cleared his throat. "I'm not very good at this philosophical shit, or, you know, metamorphosis, or whatever the hell you call it."
"Do you mean metaphysics?"
"Maybe, I don't know. I think so. But I know you can't go around disbelieving what your senses tell you.
Why, if your idea about this all being a dream is right..."
"I didn't say a dream."
"Whatever you said, that's what it comes down to, isn't it? A false reality?"
If there had been something faintly condescending in her voice a moment ago, it was gone now.
"Philosophy and metaphysics may not be your bag, Eddie, but you must have been a hell of a debater in school."
"Well, I was never in debate. That was for gays and hags and wimps. Like chess club."
"What do you mean, my bag? What's a bag?"
"Just something you like."
"What do you mean, gays? What are gays?"
He looked at her for a moment, then shrugged.
"Homos. Fags. Never mind, we could swap slang all day. It's not getting us any place. What I'm trying to say is that if it's all a dream, it could be mine, not yours. You could be a figment of my imagination."
Her smile faltered.
"You... Nobody bopped you.
Nobody bopped you either.
Now her smile was entirely gone.
No one that I remember, she corrected with some sharpness.
Me either, he said.
You told me they're rough in Oxford.
Well, those customs guys weren't exactly cheery joy when they couldn't find the dope they were after. One of them could have head-bopped me with the butt of his gun. I could be lying in a Bellevue ward right now, dreaming you and Roland, while they write their reports explaining how, while they were interrogating me, I became violent and had to be subdued.
It's not the same.
Why, because you're this intelligent, socially active black lady with no legs and I'm just a hype from Co-op City?
He said it with a grin, meaning it as an amiable jape, but she flared at him.
I wish you would stop calling me black.
He sighed.
Okay, but it's going to take getting used to.
You should have been on the debate club anyway.
Fuck, he said.
And the turn of her eyes made him realize again that the difference between them was much wider than color. They were speaking to each other from separate islands. The water between was time. Never mind, the word had gotten her attention.
I don't want to debate you. I want to wake you up to the fact that you are awake, that's all.
I might be able to at least operate provisionally according to the dictates of your third alternative as long as this situation, continued to go on, except for one thing. There's a fundamental difference between what happened to you and what happened to me. So fundamental, so large, that you haven't seen it.
Then show it to me.
There is no discontinuity in your consciousness. There is a very large one in mine.
I don't understand.
I mean, you can account for all of your time, Odetta said. Your story follows from point to point. The airplane, the incursion by that... by him.
She nodded toward the foothills with clear distaste.
The stashing of the drugs, the officers who took you into custody, all the rest. It's a fantastic story. It has no missing links.
As for myself, I arrived back from Oxford, was met by Andrew, my driver, and brought back to my building. I bathed and I wanted sleep. I was getting a very bad headache, and sleep is the only medicine that's any good for the really bad ones. But it was close on midnight, and I thought I would watch the news first. Some of us had been released, but a good many more were still in the jug when we left. I wanted to find out if their cases had been resolved. I dried off and put on my robe and went into the living room. I turned on the TV news. The newscaster started talking about a speech Khrushchev had just made about the American advisors in Vietnam. He said, "We have a film report from..." And then he was gone, and I was rolling down this beach. You say you saw me in some sort of magic doorway, which is now gone, and that I was in Macy's, and that I was stealing. All of this is preposterous enough, but even if it was so, I could find something better to steal than costume jewelry. I don't wear jewelry.
You better look at your hands again, Odetta, Eddie said quietly.
For a very long time, she looked from the diamond on her left pinky, too large and vulgar to be anything but paste, to the large opal on the third finger of her right hand, which was too large and vulgar to be anything but real.
"None of this is happening," she repeated firmly.
"You sound like a broken record."
He was genuinely angry for the first time.
"Every time someone pokes a hole in your neat little story, you just retreat to that none of this is happening shit. You have to wise up, Detta."
"Don't call me that! I hate that!"
she burst out, so shrilly that Eddie recoiled.
"Sorry. Jesus, I didn't know. I went from night to day, from undressed to dressed, from my living room to this deserted beach, and what really happened was that some big-bellied redneck deputy hit me upside the head with a club, and that is all."
"But your memories don't stop in Oxford," he said softly.
"What?"
Uncertain again. Or maybe seeing and not wanting to, like with the rings.
"If you got whacked in Oxford, how come your memories don't stop there?"
"There isn't always a lot of logic to things like this." She was rubbing her temples again.
"And now, if it's all the same to you, Eddie, I'd just as soon end the conversation. My headache is back. It's quite bad."
"I guess whether or not logic figures in all depends on what you want to believe. I saw you in Macy's, Odetta. I saw you stealing. You say you don't do things like that, but you also told me you don't wear jewelry. You told me that even though you'd looked down at your hand several times while we were talking. Those rings were there then, but it was as if you couldn't see them until I called your attention to them and made you see them."
"I don't want to talk about it," she shouted. "My head hurts."
"All right. But you know where you lost track of time, and it wasn't in Oxford."
"Leave me alone," she said dully. Eddie saw the gunslinger toiling his way back with two full water skins, one tied around his waist and the other slung over his shoulders. He looked very tired.
"I wish I could help you," Eddie said. "But to do that, I guess I'd have to be real."
He stood by her for a moment, but her head was bowed, the tips of her fingers steadily massaging her temples. Eddie went to meet Roland. 8.
"Sit down." Eddie took the bags. "You look all in."
"I am. I'm getting sick again." Eddie looked at the gunslinger's flushed cheeks and brow, his cracked lips, and nodded.
"I hoped that wouldn't happen, but I'm not that surprised, man. You didn't bat for the cycle. Balazar didn't have enough Keflex."
"I don't understand you."
"If you don't take a penicillin drug long enough, you don't kill the infection. You just drive it underground. A few days go by and it comes back. We'll need more, but at least there's a door to go to. In the meantime, you'll just have to take it easy."
But Eddie was thinking unhappily of Odetta's missing legs and the longer and longer treks it took to find water. He wondered if Roland could have picked a worse time to have a relapse. He supposed it was possible, he just didn't see how.
"I have to tell you something about Odetta."
"That's her name?"
"Uh-huh."
"It's very lovely," the gunslinger said.
"Yeah, I thought so, too. What isn't so lovely is the way she feels about this place. She doesn't think she's here."
"I know. And she doesn't like me much, does she?"
"No," Eddie thought, "but that doesn't keep her from thinking you're one booger of a hallucination."
He didn't say it, only nodded. "The reasons are almost the same," the gunslinger said. "She's not the woman I brought through, you see. Not at all." Eddie stared, then suddenly nodded, excited. That blurred glimpse in the mirror, that snarling face. The man was right. Jesus Christ, of course he was. That hadn't been Odetta at all. Then he remembered the hands which had gone pawing carelessly through the scarves and had just as carelessly gone about the business of stuffing the junk jewelry into her big purse. Almost, it had seemed, as if she wanted to be caught. The rings had been there. Same rings.
"But that doesn't necessarily mean the same hands," he thought wildly.
But that would only hold for a second. He had studied her hands. They were the same, long-fingered and delicate. "No," the gunslinger continued, "she is not." His blue eyes studied Eddie carefully.
"Her hands."
"Listen," the gunslinger said, "and listen carefully. Our lives may depend on it. Mine because I'm getting sick again, and yours because you have fallen in love with her." Eddie said nothing. "She is two women in the same body. She was one woman when I entered her, and another when I returned here." Now Eddie could say nothing. There was something else, something strange. But either I didn't understand it, or I did, and it slipped away. It seemed important. Roland looked past Eddie, looked to the beached wheelchair, standing alone at the end of its short track from nowhere. Then he looked back at Eddie. "I understand very little of this, or how such a thing can be, but you must be on your guard. Do you understand that?"
"Yes."
Eddie's lungs felt as if they had very little wind in them. He understood, or had at least a moviegoer's understanding of the sort of thing the gunslinger was speaking of, but he didn't have the breath to explain, not yet. He felt as if Roland had kicked all his breath out of him. "Good. Because the woman I entered on the other side of the door was as deadly as those lobster things that come out at night." Chapter 4. Detta on the Other Side. 1. "You must be on your guard," the gunslinger said, and Eddie had agreed. But the gunslinger knew Eddie didn't know what he was talking about. The whole back half of Eddie's mind, where survival is or isn't, didn't get the message. The gunslinger saw this. It was a good thing for Eddie he did. 2. In the middle of the night, Detta Walker's eyes sprang open. They were full of starlight and clear intelligence. She remembered everything. How she had fought them, how they had tied her into her chair, how they had taunted her, calling her nigger bitch, nigger bitch. She remembered monsters coming out of the waves, and she remembered how one of the men, the older, had killed one of them. The younger had built a fire and cooked it, and then had offered her smoking monster meat on a stick, grinning. She remembered spitting in his face, remembered his grin turning into an angry, honky scowl. He had hit her upside the face and told her, "Well, that's all right, you'll come around, nigger bitch. Wait and see if you don't." Then he and the really bad man had laughed, and the really bad man had brought out a haunch of beef, which he had spitted and slowly cooked over the fire on the beach of this alien place to which they had brought her. The smell of the slowly roasting beef had been seductive, but she had made no sign. Even when the younger one had waved a chunk of it near her face, chanting, "Bite for it, nigger bitch, go on and bite for it," she had sat like stone, holding herself in. Then she had slept, and now she was awake, and the ropes they had tied her with were gone. She was no longer in her chair, but lying on one blanket and under another, far above the high tide line, where the lobster thing still wandered and questioned and snatched the odd unfortunate gull out of the air. She looked to her left and saw nothing. She looked to her right and saw two sleeping men wrapped in two piles of blankets. The younger one was closer, and the really bad man had taken off his gun belts and laid them by him. The guns were still in them. "You made a bad mistake, Muffa," Detta thought, and rolled to her right. The gritty crunch and squeak of her body on the sand was inaudible under the wind, the waves, the questioning creatures. She crawled slowly along the sand, like one of the lobstrosities herself, her eyes glittering. She reached the gun belts and pulled one of the guns. It was very heavy, the grip smooth and somehow independently deadly in her hand. The heaviness didn't bother her. She had strong arms, did Detta Walker. She crawled a little further. The younger man was no more than a snoring rock, but the really bad man stirred a little in his sleep, and she froze with a snarl tattooed on her face until he quieted again.
"He be one sneaky son bitch. You check, Detta. You check, be sure."
She found the worn chamber release, tried to shove it forward, got nothing, and pulled it instead. The chamber swung open.
"Loaded? Fucker be loaded. You gonna do this young cocky to walk first, and that really bad man be waking up, and you gonna give him one big grin, smile, honey child, so I can see where you is, and then you gonna clean his clock something righteous."
She swung the chamber back, started to pull the hammer, and then waited. When the wind kicked up a gust, she pulled the hammer to full cock. Detta pointed Roland's gun at Eddie's temple. 3. The gunslinger watched all this from one half-open eye. The fever was back, but not bad yet, not so bad that he must mistrust himself. So he waited, that one half-open eye, the finger on the trigger of his body, the body which had always been his revolver when there was no revolver at hand. She pulled the trigger. Click. Of course, click. When he and Eddie had come back with the waterskins from their palaver, Odetta Holmes had been deeply asleep in her wheelchair, slumped to one side. They had made her the best bed they could on the sand and carried her gently from her wheelchair to the spread blankets. Eddie had been sure she would awake, but Roland knew better. He had killed, Eddie had built a fire, and they had eaten, saving a portion aside for Odetta in the morning. Then they had talked, and Eddie had said something which burst upon Roland like a sudden flare of lightning. It was too bright and too brief to be total understanding, but he saw much, the way one may discern the lay of the land in a single lucky stroke of lightning. He could have told Eddie then, but did not. He understood that he must be Eddie's court, and when one of court's pupils was left hurt and bleeding by some unexpected blow, court's response had always been the same. "A child doesn't understand a hammer until he's mashed his finger at a nail. Get up and stop whining, maggot. You have forgotten the face of your father." So Eddie had fallen asleep, even though Roland had told him he must be on his guard. And when Roland was sure they both slept, he had waited longer for the lady, who could, he thought, be sly. He had reloaded his guns with spent casings, unstrapped them, that caused a pang, and put them by Eddie. Then he waited. 1 hour, 2, 3. Halfway through the 4th hour, as his tired and feverish body tried to drowse, he sensed, rather than saw, the lady come awake, and came fully awake himself. He watched her roll over. He watched her turn her hands into claws and pull herself along the sand to where his gun belts lay. He watched her take one of them out, come closer to Eddie, and then pause, her head cocking, her nostrils swelling and contracting, doing more than smelling the air, tasting it. Yes, this was the woman he had brought across. When she glanced toward the gunslinger, he did more than feign sleep, because she would have sensed sham. He went to sleep. When he sensed her gaze shift away, he awoke and opened that single eye again. He saw her begin to raise the gun. She did this with less effort than Eddie had shown the first time Roland saw him do the same thing, and point it toward Eddie's head. Then she paused, her face filled with an inexpressible cunning. In that moment, she reminded him of Martin. She fiddled with the cylinder, getting it wrong at first, then swinging it open. She looked at the heads of the shells. Roland tensed, waiting first to see if she would know the firing pins had already been struck, waiting next to see if she would turn the gun, look into the other end of the cylinder, and see there was only emptiness there instead of lead. He had thought of loading the guns with cartridges which had already misfired, but only briefly. Court had taught them that every gun is ultimately ruled by old man Splitfoot, and a cartridge which misfires once may not do so a second time. If she did that, he would spring at once. But she swung the cylinder back in, began to cock the hammer, and then paused again. Paused for the wind to mask the single low click. He thought, here is another. God, she's evil, this one, and she's legless, but she's a gunslinger, as sure as Eddie is one. He waited with her. The wind gusted. She pulled the hammer to full cock and placed it half an inch from Eddie's temple. With a grin that was a ghoul's grimace, she pulled the trigger. Click. He waited. She pulled it again, and again, and again. Click, click, click.
Muffer!
She screamed and reversed the gun with liquid grace. Roland coiled but did not leap. A child doesn't understand a hammer until he's mashed his finger at a nail. If she kills him, she kills you. Doesn't matter, the voice of Court answered inexorably. Eddie stirred, and his reflexes were not bad. He moved fast enough to avoid being driven unconscious or killed. Instead of coming down on the vulnerable temple, the heavy gun butt cracked the side of his jaw.
What? Jesus! Martha! Honky Martha!
Detta screamed, and Roland saw her raise the gun a second time. And even though she was legless and Eddie was rolling away, it was as much as he dared. If Eddie hadn't learned the lesson now, he never would. The next time the gunslinger told Eddie to be on his guard, Eddie would be. And besides, the bitch was quick. It would not be wise to depend further than this on either Eddie's quickness or the lady's infirmity. He uncoiled, flying over Eddie and knocking her backward, ending up on top of her.
"You want it, mother?"
she screamed at him, simultaneously rolling her crotch against his groin and raising the arm which still held the gun above his head.
"You want it? I gon' give you what you want, show!"
"Eddie!" he shouted again, not just yelling now, but commanding. For a moment, Eddie just went on squatting there, eyes wide, blood dripping from his jaw. It had already begun to swell, staring, eyes wide. "Move! Can't you move?" he thought. "Or is it that you don't want to?" His strength was fading now, and the next time she brought that heavy gun butt down, she was going to break his arm with it. That was, if he got his arm up in time. If he didn't, she was going to break his head with it. Then Eddie moved. He caught the gun on the downswing, and she shrieked, turning toward him, biting at him like a vampire, cursing him in a gutter patois so darkly southern that even Eddie couldn't understand it. To Roland, it sounded as if the woman had suddenly begun to speak in a foreign language. But Eddie was able to yank the gun out of her hand, and with the impending bludgeon gone, Roland was able to pin her. She did not quit even then, but continued to buck and heave and curse, sweat standing out all over her dark face. Eddie stared, mouth opening and closing like the mouth of a fish. He touched tentatively at his jaw, winced, pulled his fingers back, examined them and the blood on them. She was screaming that she would kill them both. They could try and rape her, but she would kill them with her cunt. They would see. That was one bad son of a bitch in cave with teeth around the entrance, and if they wanted to try and explore it, they would find out. "What in the hell?" Eddie said stupidly. "One of my gun belts," the gunslinger panted harshly at him. "Get it. I'm going to roll her over on top of me, and you're going to grab her arms and tie her hands behind her." "You ain't never!" Detta shrieked, and sunfished her legless body with such sudden force that she almost bucked Roland off. He felt her trying to bring the remainder of her right thigh up again and again, wanting to drive it into his balls.
She... "Move, gods curse your father's face!" Roland roared. And at last Eddie moved.
4. They almost lost control of her twice during the tying and binding, but Eddie was at last able to slip knot one of Roland's gun belts around her wrists when Roland, using all his force, finally brought them together behind her, all the time drawing back from her lunging bites like a mongoose from a snake, the bites he avoided, but before Eddie had finished, the gunslinger was drenched with spittle, and then Eddie dragged her off, holding the short leash of the makeshift slipknot to do it. He did not want to hurt this thrashing, screaming, cursing thing. It was uglier than the lobstrosities, by far, because of the greater intelligence which informed it, but he knew it could also be beautiful. He did not want to harm the other person the vessel held somewhere inside it, like a live dove deep inside one of the secret compartments in a magician's magic box. Odetta Holmes was somewhere inside that screaming, screeching thing. 5. Although his last mount, a mule, had died too long ago to remember, the gunslinger still had a piece of its tether rope, which in turn had once been a fine gunslinger's lariat. They used this to bind her in her wheelchair, as she had imagined, or falsely remembered, and in the end they both came to the same thing, didn't they? They had done already. Then they drew away from her. If not for the crawling lobster things, Eddie would have gone down to the water and washed his hands.
"I feel like I'm going to vomit," he said in a voice that jig-jagged up and down the scale like the voice of an adolescent boy. "Why don't you go on and eat each other's cocks?" the struggling thing in the chair screeched. "Why don't you just go on and do that if you're afraid of a black woman's cunny? You just go on, show, suck on your each one's candles. Do it while you got a chance, 'cause Daddy Walker gonna get out in his chair and cut them skinny old white candles off and feed them to those walking buzzsaws down there."
"She's the woman I was in. Do you believe me now?"
"I believed you before," Eddie said. "I told you that."
You believed. You believed it on the top of your mind. Do you believe it all the way down now? All the way to the bottom?" Eddie looked at the shrieking, convulsing thing in the chair, and then looked away, white except for the slash on his jaw, which was still dripping a little. That side of his face was beginning to look a little like a balloon.
"Yes," he said. "God, yes.
This woman is a monster." Eddie began to cry. The gunslinger wanted to comfort him, could not commit such a sacrilege. He remembered Jake too well, and walked off into the dark with his new fever burning and aching inside him. 6. Much earlier on that night, while Odetta still slept, Eddie said he thought he might understand what was wrong with her. Might. The gunslinger asked what he meant.
"She could be a schizophrenic."
Roland only shook his head. Eddie explained what he understood of schizophrenia, gleanings from such films as The Three Faces of Eve and various TV programs, mostly the soap operas he and Henry had often watched while stoned. Roland had nodded. Yes. The disease Eddie described sounded about right. A woman with two faces, one light and one dark. A face like the one the man in black had shown him on the fifth tarot card. And they don't know, these schizophrenes, that they have another?
No,
Eddie said. But... He trailed off, moodily watching the lobstrosities crawl and question, question and crawl. But what?
I'm no shrink, Eddie said. So I don't really know shrink.
What is a shrink? Eddie tapped his temple.
A head doctor. A doctor for your mind. They're really called psychiatrists.
Roland nodded. He liked shrink better, because this lady's mind was too large, twice as large as it needed to be.
But I think schizos almost always know something is wrong with them, Eddie said, because there are blanks. Maybe I'm wrong, but I always got the idea that there were usually two people who thought they had partial amnesia, because of the blank spaces in their memories when the other personality was in control. She says she remembers everything. She really thinks she remembers everything.
I thought you said she didn't believe any of this was happening.
Yeah, Eddie said. But forget that for now. I'm trying to say that no matter what she believes, what she remembers goes right from her living room where she was sitting in her bathrobe watching the midnight news to here, with no break at all. She doesn't have any sense that some other person took over between then and when you grabbed her in Macy's. Hell, that might have been the next day, or even weeks later. I know it was still winter, because most of the shoppers in that store were wearing coats.
The gunslinger nodded. Eddie's perceptions were sharpening. That was good. He had missed the boots and scarves, the gloves sticking out of coat pockets, but it was still a start.
But otherwise, it's impossible to tell how long Odetta was that other woman, because she doesn't know. I think she's in a situation she's never been in before, and her way of protecting both sides is a story about getting cracked over the head.
Roland nodded.
And the rings. Seeing those really shook her up. She tried not to show it, but it showed all right.
Roland asked, if these two women don't know they exist in the same body, and if they don't even suspect that something may be wrong, if each has her own separate chain of memories, partly real but partly made up to fit the times the other is there, what are we to do with her? How are we even to live with her? Eddie had shrugged.
Don't ask me. It's your problem. You're the one who says you need her. Hell, you risked your neck to bring her here.
Eddie thought about this for a minute, remembered squatting over Roland's body with Roland's knife held just above the gunslinger's throat, and laughed abruptly and without humor.
Literally risked your neck, man, he thought.
A silence fell between them. Odetta had by then been breathing quietly. As the gunslinger was about to reiterate his warning for Eddie to be on guard and announce loud enough for the lady to hear if she was only shamming that he was going to turn in, Eddie said the thing which lighted Roland's mind in a single sudden glare, the thing which made him understand at least part of what he needed so badly to know. At the end, when they came through, she had changed at the end. And he had seen something, some thing.
"Tell you what," Eddie said, moodily stirring the remains of the fire with a split claw from this night's kill. "When you brought her through, I felt like I was a schizo."
"Why?" Eddie thought, then shrugged. It was too hard to explain. Or maybe he was just too tired.
"It's not important."
"Why?" Eddie looked at Roland, saw he was asking a serious question for a serious reason, or thought he was, and took a minute to think back.
"It's really hard to describe, man. It was looking in that door. That's what freaked me out. When you see someone move in that door, it's like you're moving with them. You know what I'm talking about."
Roland nodded.
"Well, I watched it like it was a movie. Never mind, it's not important. Until the very end. Then you turned her toward this side of the doorway, and for the first time I was looking at myself. It was like..."
He groped and could find nothing.
"I don't know. It should have been like looking in a mirror, I guess, but it wasn't. Because it was like looking at another person. It was like being turned inside out. Like being in two places at the same time. Shit, I don't know."
But the gunslinger was thunderstruck. That was what he had sensed as they came through. That was what had happened to her.
"No,"
Not just her. Them. For a moment, Detta and Odetta had looked at each other. Not the way one would look at her reflection in a mirror, but as separate people. The mirror became a window pane, and for a moment Odetta had seen Detta, and Detta had seen Odetta, and had been equally horror-struck. They each know, the gunslinger thought grimly. They may not have known before, but they do now. They can try to hide it from themselves, but for a moment they saw, they knew, and that knowing must still be there.
Roland?
What?
Just wanted to make sure you hadn't gone to sleep with your eyes open, because for a minute you looked like you were, you know, long ago and far away.
If so, I'm back now, the gunslinger said. I'm going to turn in. Remember what I said, Eddie. Be on your guard.
I'll watch, Eddie said.
But Roland knew that, sick or not, he would have to be the one to do the watching tonight. Everything else had followed from that. 7. Following the ruckus, Eddie and Detta Walker eventually went to sleep again. She did not so much fall asleep as drop into an exhausted state of unconsciousness in her chair, lolling to one side against the restraining ropes. The gunslinger, however, lay wakeful. "I will have to bring the two of them to battle," he thought. But he didn't need one of Eddie's shrinks to tell him that such a battle might be to the death. If the Bright One, Odetta, were to win that battle, all might yet be well. If the Dark One were to win it, all would surely be lost with her. Yet he sensed that what really needed doing was not killing, but joining. He had already recognized much that would be of value to him, them, in Detta Walker's gutter toughness, and he wanted her. But he wanted her under control. There was a long way to go. Detta thought he and Eddie were monsters of some species she called Honk Muffas. That was only dangerous delusion, but there would be real monsters along the way. The Lobstrosities were not the first, nor would they be the last. The fight-until-you-drop woman he had entered and who would come out of hiding again tonight might come in very handy in a fight against such monsters if she could be tempered by Odetta Holmes's calm humanity, especially now, with him short two fingers, almost out of bullets and growing more fever. But that is a step ahead. I think if I can make them acknowledge each other, that would bring them into confrontation. How may it be done? He lay awake all that long night thinking, and although he felt the fever in him grow, he found no answer to his question. 8. Eddie woke up shortly before daybreak, saw the gunslinger sitting near the ashes of last night's fire, with his blanket wrapped around him Indian fashion, and joined him.
"How do you feel?" Eddie asked in a low voice.
The lady still slept in her criss-crossing of ropes, although she occasionally jerked and muttered and moaned.
"All right."
Eddie gave him an appraising glance.
"You don't look all right."
"Thank you, Eddie," the gunslinger said dryly.
"You're shivering."
"It will pass." The lady jerked and moaned again, this time a word that was almost understandable. It might have been Oxford.
"God, I hate to see you tied up like that," Eddie murmured, "like a goddamn calf in a barn."
"She'll wake soon. Mayhap we can unloose her when she does." It was the closest either of them came to saying out loud that when the lady in the chair opened her eyes, the calm, if slightly puzzled, gaze of Odetta Holmes might greet them. 15 minutes later, as the first sun rays struck over the hills, those eyes did open. But what the men saw was not the calm gaze of Odetta Holmes, but the mad glare of Detta Walker.
"How many times you done raped me while I was buzzed out?" she asked. "My cunt feel all slick and tallowy, like somebody done been at it with a couple of them little bitty white candles you gray meat muffas call cocks."
Roland sighed. "Let's get going," he said, and gained his feet with a grimace.
I ain't going nowhere with you, mother,"
Detta spat.
"Oh, yes, you are," Eddie said. "Dreadfully sorry, my dear. Where you think I'm gone?"
"Well," Eddie said, "what was behind door number one wasn't so hot, and what was behind door number two was even worse. So now, instead of quitting like sane people, we're going to go right on ahead and check out door number three. The way things have been going, I think it's likely to be something like Godzilla or Ghidra, the three-headed monster. But I'm an optimist. I'm still hoping for the stainless steel cookware."
"I ain't going."
"You're going, all right," Eddie said, and walked behind her chair. She began struggling again, but the gunslinger had made these knots, and her struggles only drew them tighter. Soon enough she saw this and ceased. She was full of poison, but far from stupid. But she looked back over her shoulder at Eddie with a grin which made him recoil a little. It seemed to him the most evil expression he had ever seen on a human face.
"Well, maybe I'll be going on a little way," she said. "But maybe not so far as you think, white boy. And sure God, not so fast as you think."
"What do you mean?" That leering, over-the-shoulder grin again.
"You find out, white boy."
Her eyes, mad but cogent, shifted briefly to the gunslinger.
"You both be finding that out."
Eddie wrapped his hands around the bicycle grips at the ends of the push handles on the back of her wheelchair, and they began north again, now leaving not only footprints, but the twin tracks of the lady's chair as they moved up the seemingly endless beach. 9. The day was a nightmare. It was hard to calculate distance traveled when you were moving along a landscape which varied so little, but Eddie knew their progress had slowed to a crawl. And he knew who was responsible. Oh, yeah.
"You both be finding that out," Detta had said.
And they hadn't been on the move more than half an hour before the finding out began. Pushing. That was the first thing. Pushing the wheelchair up a beach of fine sand would have been as impossible as driving a car through deep, unplowed snow. This beach, with its gritty, marly surface, made moving the chair possible, but far from easy. It would roll along smoothly enough for a while, crunching over shells and popping little pebbles to either side of its hard rubber tires, and then it would hit a dip where finer sand had drifted, and Eddie would have to shove, grunting, to get it and its solid, unhelpful passenger through it. The sand sucked greedily at the wheels. You had to simultaneously push and throw your weight against the handles of the chair in a downward direction, or it and its bound occupant would tumble over face first onto the beach. Detta would cackle as he tried to move her without upending her.
"You having a good time back there, honey child?"
she asked each time the chair ran into one of these dry bogs. When the gunslinger moved over to help, Eddie motioned him away.
"You get your chance," he said. "We'll switch off."
"But I think my turns are going to be a hell of a lot longer than his," a voice in his head spoke up. "The way he looks, he's going to have his hands full just keeping himself moving before much longer, let alone moving the woman in his chair. No, sir, Eddie, I'm afraid this bud's for you. It's God's revenge, you know it? All those years you spent as a junkie, and guess what? You're finally the pusher." He uttered a short, out-of-breath laugh.
"What's so funny, white boy?"
Detta asked, and although Eddie thought she meant to sound sarcastic, it came out sounding just a tiny bit angry. "Ain't supposed to be any laughs in this for me," he thought. "None at all. Not as far as she's concerned."
"You wouldn't understand, babe. Just let it lie." "I be letting you lie before this be all over," she said. "Be letting you and your badass buddy there lie in pieces all over this beach show. Meantime, you better save your breath to do your pushing with. You already sound like you're getting a little short-winded."
"Well, you talk for both of us, then," Eddie panted. "You never seem to run out of wind."
"I gonna break wind, gray meat. Gonna break it over your dead face."
"Promises, promises." Eddie shoved the chair out of the sand and onto relatively easier going, for a while at least. The sun was not yet fully up, but he had already worked up a sweat. "This is going to be an amusing and informative day," he thought. "I can see that already."